The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 31. Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Guys, how's everybody doing tonight on the live stream? I got my good buddy here, Mr. Jason Hartman.
Hey, George. Great to be here with you.
He actually came down to visit in Medellin. He's right in Miami, so quick three-hour flight. So we got him on the live stream tonight. We're going to try to take maybe a couple real estate questions, but he actually knows quite a bit about macro. So we might get some of those questions, have him answer some macro questions. Of course, I'll be answering them as well. We've got Sebastian, as always, taking the super chat. So if you guys want to make sure that I see that question and answer it to the best of my ability, go ahead and do a super chat. And Sebastian will text that to me in real time. Couple reminders, if you guys are interested in going to Rick Rule's Resource Symposium this summer, I am going to be there. George Gammon in the flesh. We can go out, shake hands, ask me questions, or I can ask you questions, grab a beer. I'm not going to be speaking there, but I will be attending. Guys like Jim Rickards will be there. Obviously, Rick Rule, Doug Casey, Ross Beattie, all these awesome people that you could hear speak live. So if you're interested in going, make sure that you use our affiliate link. I just got that hooked up with Rick last week. Sebastian has that up at georgegammon.com. And with that, I can get right into it.
And let's do it.
You ready, buddy?
Let's do it.
Yeah. All right, let's make it happen. Okay, so super chats. Oh, and guys, if you're in the chat feed, if you have a question, make sure that you write question all capital letters so that I can see it when we're between super chats. Okay, Tony, thank you for the super chat, buddy. He asks, when looking at homes, is there a certain thing that you look for, like checking the water meter to see if there are any hidden leaks? Tony, how much time you got, buddy?
That's a home inspector question.
Yeah, that's. Yeah. I think that's the best thing that I would do is to just make sure that if you're considering a purchase, whether it's your own home or a rental property, that you're getting it inspected in advance. Those guys do like a 500-point checklist, report. Yeah. It's a couple hundred bucks, no brainer.
Yeah, absolutely. Have a home inspection all the time, unless you're buying from a big national builder with a good reputation, you definitely want to have a home inspection, even sometimes on brand new properties, if it's a little mom and pop builder, definitely. And remember, in some states, home inspectors are licensed, in some states they're not. So you also want to find a credible home inspector because the quality of the inspection can vary.
Okay. Yeah. Let's see, Tyler. And one thing I'd add to that, Tony, whenever I'm looking at a property to potentially buy, I'm just going through and just looking at the foundation, the roof. There are a lot of things that you can do right off the bat before you even get an inspector to know if it's a deal that you might want to just pass on. I would say HVAC, I'd say roof and foundation.
The big systems, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Tyler, thank you for the super chat. Says, where are you putting your own speculation money right now? Well, right now, I don't have much in speculation, Tyler, because I've got so much tied up in real estate. But I'm glad you asked that question because I'm going to be selling a couple projects here in Medellin very soon. So with that additional liquidity, I'm going to be building up that side of my portfolio even more. When I do that, I'm going to be taking you guys along with me, whether I invest in the miners, silver miners, Bitcoin, I'm not sure. But whatever I do, I will share that with the community. I'll give you my rationale. I'll probably do whiteboard videos on it. And I'll definitely mention it in the live stream.
And it was cool, really, to see George's projects here. We toured at least some of them. Mm-hmm. And those are really cool. Good stuff you're doing. Yeah.
Okay. Funding Jim, what's up, buddy? I think you're coming down here to Medellin as well. So we'll see you soon. Best way to keep gains from the sale of a rental, then lose tax and broker fees. 1031 ? Other tips ? Roll over the profit. Well, that's probably
That's a good one. That's a good one. So I've done a bunch of 1031 exchanges. It seems like every year I'm doing a 1031 exchange. Very good strategy. For those of you who don't know, that's a way to defer the taxes on the sale of your properties, and you can keep deferring them for life. And under current law, when you pass them on to your heirs, basis steps up to market value. So it's the most tax favored asset class in America. But there are some other options. One of them is called the deferred sales trust. Another one's called the monetized installment sale, or you can just do an installment sale with the buyer, or you can offset that gain with something else. And there are vehicles, of course, that, you know, offer you paper losses. We hope they're just on paper, that can offset gain. So,
Okay. Conrad, thank you for the super chat. Asks, VA loan stats, must live in unit, fourplex max, zero property taxes, no loan limit, zero down, APR 30 year at 3.2%. Do you think this is still, this will still exist after the crash? My personal experience when I was investing in 2012 is debt was really hard to get, but I don't know how it would work with the VA stuff. Do you have,
You know, when there is a crash, the government always wants to stimulate. They can't get enough stimulating the economy, right? Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know, under the way things currently work, you'll probably see VA loans quite available, but
still, were they last time?
I think they were pretty much
okay. The
same. Yeah. I mean, we don't do a lot of VA financing, so, but that is a good house hack, by the way. If you're just starting out to get a Plex, live in one of the units, you get that great owner-occupied VA or FHA financing, and then you rent the others out. I don't love the idea of Plexes or living close to my tenants. You know, I want to have arm's length, but it's not a bad deal.
Yeah, I think especially for young people,
it's just starting out,
amazing financial decision. Mm-hmm. Okay, Conrad's got another question. I get $3,300 a month tax-free from a VA, 1-2%. My job will bring in $3,000 after taxes. This is why I want a fourplex. But you're right, California sucks.
The Socialist Republic of California, my home state. Yeah, it's California is the most overrated place in the universe.
Yeah,
not that I have an opinion about that, but
unfortunately, it's getting worse too.
Yeah, it is. It really is.
Yeah. Okay, Boogie, thank you for the super chat. Says Epstein didn't kill himself. Well, I don't know. I'll let you guys decide that, but. I appreciate you sharing your opinion with us.
My comment on that one is maybe he did kill himself, but he wasn't prevented from killing himself, which he should have been.
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah.
All right. So let's go to the live stream or the live chat. I'm not sure. I'm looking at the question. It says, I've got a family issue with my mom disappearing, but my dad has her name on the property.
Oh, I get the idea.
Fixed to an adjustable rate mortgage.
So,
is there anything we can do to change the
I'm guessing what you're saying is you want to refinance the property and mother has disappeared. So she's on title and maybe they can't control the property with mom disappearing like that. I'm sorry to hear that. That's terrible. But get her to come back so she can sign the loan docs and you can refi. I don't know. Is that maybe the question? I don't quite get the question.
Yeah, he's saying, is there anything they can do if they can't find the other person?
Go to court, get a court order. A judge has to make a ruling to essentially convey the deed or from that person that's disappeared. That requires a lawyer.
Yeah. Hey, Stephanie asks, If we have decent equity in a property to do a cash out refi to purchase another property, would you take out just until you're making enough cash flow, or do you use as much as you can?
My opinion is always get as much leverage as you can, as long as it's good quality leverage and it's not expensive. And right now, leverage is cheap, as long as it's conventional financing and it's fantastic. So I believe in equity stripping, getting the equity out of that property when possible, so you have control of that equity and it's not subject to the property. A lot of people say leverage is a two-edged sword. It kind of is. That's, you know, an old saying. I'd rather have control of that money and not have it locked up in the property. If there's a crash and you need that money, if it's in the bank, you can, as long as the banks don't fail. Okay. Yeah. That's a much bigger problem, but you can get that money. You can use it. If it's in the property, you're never going to get a refi during a crash. That's going to be really hard to access that money, especially if you lose your job too. You know, if you've got that money out and it's under your control, you've already taken the money out. So you're in a much more powerful position.
Yeah. I said we want to talk macro in every single question.
I know. Give us some macro questions. I was thinking the same thing. Macroeconomics, folks. There's more to life than real estate, even though real estate's the best investment in the entire world.
Wow. We don't agree on it. We agree on a lot. I think we agree on 80%.
What do you think the most historically proven asset class is if it's not?
Well, it depends on what your objective is. Well, that's how I do it. So if you're looking at an investment, it's got to pay you to own it.
Yes.
I think that it's tough to beat real estate.
Yeah.
But if you're looking at a speculation, I think there could be better speculations. Or if you're looking at insurance, I think there's better insurance. So it all depends on what your objective is.
Okay. So when you say insurance, you're talking about life insurance?
No. I'm talking about gold.
Oh, okay. Oh, insurance against monetary collapse and coronavirus.
Yeah. You got
spooks.
It.
Spooks. And then what were you talking about with the other
speculation?
One? So what would you speculate in, mining stocks?
Or? Well, right now, I think Bitcoin could be interesting. I think the silver miners could be interesting. Mm-hmm. The gold miners.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things, but it differs from time to time. Yeah, sometimes a real estate could be a fantastic speculation. Mm-hmm. If you're able to go like in 2012,
yeah,
would have been a great speculation back then.
Sure.
Yeah. But back, it was even better investment back then because you're buying that cash flow.
Right.
So it all depends on the environment, as you say, compared to what, and then what your objective is with that portion of your portfolio. Mm-hmm. At least that's the way I look at it.
Fair enough. I mean, listen, I don't teach or talk much about speculation, but you know, if you've built up a certain amount of wealth, it's perfectly okay to speculate with 10, 15, even 20% of your portfolio. Just don't speculate with what you can't afford to lose.
Yeah. That's all. Yeah. And that's why I always say 10% insurance, 80% investment, 10% speculation.
I like George's 80, 10 and 10 plan.
Yeah.
It's a good one.
Okay. Conrad asks, is there any city in California that could ever work?
You know, the Inland Empire in Southern California, Riverside, San Bernardino County, during the worst part of the Great Recession, the deals there were actually marginally attractive.
Okay.
And it turned out
they did, ratio?
Yeah, from an RV ratio. They almost got to where we considered recommending those markets.
Wow.
They didn't get good enough. But when the turnaround happened, they definitely appreciated nicely. But they weren't good enough for us. California never gets quite that good. If things get any worse in California, though, it may get that good in the future.
Yeah.
But that's not the kind of good you want to chase.
Yeah. Okay. Same shirt, different day. I think they're referring to me. I always wear this white shirt.
I just want you to know that being at George's place, and he told me, by the way, if you want to buy George a gift, a Brooks Brothers shirt, he likes Brooks Brothers, and they're not the same shirt. He has a few.
Okay, how much do you pay for freelance real estate photos?
Oh, good question. Hmm. Yeah. So there's a company that I've interviewed on my podcast called WeGoLook.com. And they'll go pretty much anywhere and take a photo or a video of anything and report to you on it. A lot of insurance companies use them. Hmm. Real estate investors, $69 was the last I knew their pricing started there. If it's really rural, you know, they're going to charge you more. I don't know if you mean professional photos or just because you want to know something about a property you have remotely. For professional real estate photos for marketing purposes, anywhere from $100 to $300 and up. I mean, there are real estate photographers that come in and do overlays and HDR and all video, kinds of, and they'll spend a day at a house, a full day. Mm-hmm. So the sky's the limit, but a couple $100.
Okay, cool. All right, let me try to find some macro questions here, guys. That's what this channel is.
There's
all
more
about.
To life than real estate. I can't believe I'm saying that.
Oh, they're all real estate.
Well, okay, we'll talk about real estate. Okay, folks, twist my arm. there's a super one. Chat okay, about miners, right?
Okay, so Conrad asks Sprout. I think he's talking about Sprott. Yeah. Sprott and Schiff find miners. I buy those. Good question mark.
Well, you just said you like miners for speculation, right?
Yeah, I do. I do, especially the silver miners right now. I would be pretty confident in anything Sprott does, just because I've been following Rick Rule for so long and he is so sharp, and just having the opportunity to interview him and talk to him kind of off camera, if you will. He's just like that when he's not doing interviews. It's just sharp as a tack. I think he's extremely trustworthy. And so I think that that could be definitely an option. With Schiff, I know Schiff has got a gold fund that is really rated high with Morningstar, I think 5 stars. And but I know his fees are a little bit higher. So I'm not sure about Schiff, although same thing. I would trust that he knows his stuff, or is going to hire someone to pick companies that really know their stuff. But I think you'd be pretty good starting there, but just do as much research as you possibly can to find out what's going to be the best fit for you. I think that's probably the best advice. And then, again, moving forward, when I start to make these investments or more of these investments for myself, I'll let you guys know what I find through the process of due diligence. So hopefully that'll save you guys some time. Okay, Ben asks, how much cash should you set aside per rental unit in case of vacancy in the next downturn?
Great question.
That is a very good question.
The answer is a minimum of 4% of the value of the unit or your portfolio. So in other words, if you have a $1 million portfolio, maybe you've got 10 $100,000 single family homes, 40 grand set aside for emergencies and unexpected things. You never want to be forced to liquidate a property by, you know, extraneous circumstances.
Right.
Okay. So 4% of the value of the portfolio. You could set aside more if you want, but don't overdo it, because remember, when your money's in cash, you're not earning a return. Inflation and taxes are just eating you alive. So don't overdo it, but at least 4% mm-hmm. of the value of the properties.
Okay. Stay Curious asks, why Gucci? Why not Allen Edmonds or Alden? I really like Gucci loafers.
I've never had a pair.
Yeah.
I could never be convinced to spend $500-$600 for a pair of shoes. You did that, huh?
I've spent a lot more than that.
Oh, wow.
I don't want to admit how much I've spent on some pairs of shoes. This is really going off on a tangent here. But the new Guccis, I don't like them as much. I really like Guccis a lot better than Tom Ford was designing them. I never thought I'd be talking
about
this.
See, now we're talking about macro. This is macro. didn't want to talk all about real estate.
Yeah, when Tom Ford was at Gucci, I loved them. But since then, I think they've kind of gone downhill. But I like Ferragamo, Prada. Louis Vuitton's okay, maybe a little over the top. But yeah, I'm a big fan of Gucci's, that's for sure. At least I used to be.
How about Allen Edmonds? I like Allen Edmonds. I purchased their shoes. You don't like them. Okay, you know what to send George for his next birthday.
Okay, Boogie Boogie asks, what exotic cars do you own? Trump Tide, I'm not sure what that means, but what kind of exotic cars do I? Well, currently, I don't own any, believe it or not. I've owned a lot in my life. The last one I had was a Maserati Gran Turismo. I don't know if you'd consider that exotic.
That's an exotic. A Maserati is an exotic. Okay. They've tried to go more mainstream. You know, they got down to like 70 grand for a car, which is almost mainstream, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was the last one I have. I really don't. I mean, in Colombia, having a car is really a pain in the butt.
Yeah.
And to be clear, I don't suggest you using your money to buy an exotic car. It's a
waste of money
pit.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
Yeah, totally.
The reason I just have to have a vice every once in a while. So that was my vice. My vice has always been cars and clothing. So you got to live a little bit, I guess.
You gotta waste money on something, right?
Yeah.
No, I never got into boats.
No, I always, I did glider lessons for a while.
Oh yeah.
Which I love.
Glider's fun. Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't want to buy that stuff. Okay. Let's see. Conrad, Junk Silver, good Mad Max money. I like 90% down. Yeah, I've heard that. That is good. So if things really, really get bad, having dimes that are actually when they used to make them out of silver.
Yeah, I own some Junk Silver.
Yeah, that could be interesting.
The problem with silver, I mean, not as an investment, just as a practical matter, is, you know, if I'm going to own precious metals or one of my companies is, I want to take possession of it. Mm-hmm. And the silver is just too big and bulky to move, you know. It's you can't get enough money in it for the bulk.
Yeah.
You know, and the weight. Kind of a good problem to have, though.
Matthew asks, thank you for the super chat, by the way, Matthew. I'm 26 years old. I have $2,000 in savings. Good for you, buddy. 4K in dividend yielding stocks, okay, and 2 ounces of gold. Should I take money out of the stocks and or savings to buy gold? Well, let's think this through. So you've got 2,000, you got 6,000. So your net worth right now is 6 ounces. So call it 3, so 9, maybe call it 10 grand. And then you're talking about 10. No, after I'm doing the math in my head, I would not do that because you've got well over 10% of your portfolio in gold. So if you're looking at, you don't really have enough for a down payment on a house.
Maybe focus on, do you have a business, your own business? Or maybe,
exactly.
You know, you get a focus at that age and based on that portfolio size and in increasing income.
Yeah,
you know,
for
that's
sure.
a huge sure. thing. Maybe taking a second job or if you've got a little side hustle, a little business, you know, there's you can start a company now for $100, you know, an online business.
Yeah. If you want to do something that I've done in the past, Matthew, that I've had a lot of success with just as a fun side hustle. And I won't go into the reason why I was doing it, but many, 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 many moons ago, as most of you know, I would flip trucks on the side and I'd keep them as a store of value, old diesel trucks. And with $4,000, that might be a little tight, but with $4,000, you could maybe think about doing something along the same lines. Let's see, have I done deals with that? I have, in fact. Let me think this through.
What kind of trucks? I didn't know this.
Oh, yeah. So with $4,000, let me just think this through out loud so you guys can get the actual numbers, especially the 460s. So back in between 90, you want to go with the OBS on the gas for the Fords going, you know, 94 to 97 and like F-250. The 460s, you can get them super, super cheap right now in California because the gas is so high. And if you've got a truck that's only getting 5 miles to the gallon, no one wants that in California and no one can sell it. And that's the key. So if you find a really good 460 that let's say has 100 or 110,000 miles on it, that's maybe dirty or it's been on a farm, something like that. And you can get that on Craigslist with maybe $3,000. And then you put 1,000 into it to pretty it up. And then you take awesome pictures, flip it, put it up on eBay. You can get a lot of that money.
What do you do, sell it in Texas?
No, on the East Coast, where they have rust.
Oh.
Because all the trucks rust out.
Oh.
And so that body style is extremely popular right now. So as a real example, I've gone in and bought 460s and been all in, maybe a little more than $4,000, maybe $5,000-$6,000. And I've sold them on eBay for $15,000.
Folks, you're talking to a Renaissance man here, flipping trucks. Those aren't commercial trucks then.
No, just four F-250s.
Crew
cabs, extended cabs.
I had no idea.
Yeah. So I would think about doing something like that, Matthew. It might not have to be trucks. It could be something just like normal cars, but you have to study it and know it so well that you know that arbitrage. But it's definitely doable. And if I was in your shoes with that portfolio, that's probably what I'd do to build it up to where you've got enough to have some more flexibility. Or more options. Okay, let's get back here. We're getting behind on the super chats. Okay, Cloud TNT, thank you very much for the super chat. Says at Jason Hartman, it's wildly recommended to find cash flow properties with a COC of 10 to 15%. Why is that all the turnkey properties? Okay, why is it that all the turkey properties only show 5 to 8% at best? Is that because the market is inflated?
Yes. I would say the market has certainly inflated a lot. COC stands for cash on cash return. that's a good metric to use. It's not the whole story, but it's pretty good. And so if you put X amount of dollars into the property and you get X amount back, that's basically your cash on cash return. And if you can get 10 to 15%, I haven't seen that in years. I mean, occasionally we'll get a rare property, but that is a phenomenal cash on cash return in this market.
Okay.
You know, people settle for a lot less than that. You know, we haven't seen many 10 to 15% cash on cash properties. And by the way, when I say this, I'm talking about quality properties. Look, you can go into the hood and buy junk properties that, you know, look good on paper, but you're never going to collect the rents. They always look so much better than they really are.
Yeah.
And you don't want to buy those type of properties by and large, unless, like you said about the trucks, if you're a total expert and you're really focused on that and you have enough capital to truly lift up a whole neighborhood,
right,
then, you know, that is a whole different game. But you're not going to see cash on cash return on quality properties. If you can get 7, 8, 9, 10%, you're doing great for quality property.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Unless you're in Columbia. I get that.
Okay. I'm talking about the United States.
I know. Yeah, I'm giving you a hard time. Yeah, I'm giving you a hard time. Okay. Back to the super chat. DL, thank you for the super chat, asks, is a market crash inevitable? What prevents the Fed from propping stock and real estate markets up indefinitely, at least in nominal terms? Well, nominal terms, nothing. Well, I'm not going to say nothing. There could be a few things that would prevent them, because on the real estate side, people still have to take out loans. On the stock side, people... See, then you've got the financial economy, and then you've got the big banks there. You got pension funds. There's a lot of different variables there. But, I mean, look at Japan. They went in and just bought the whole ETF market. They pretty much own the bond market. The Fed could technically do that to prop things up. And you're right, in nominal terms, not much. But in real terms, which is what we should care about, can they prop that up? Maybe not. And I always use the Venezuelan stock market as an example of that. So you look at it just goes straight up, but in real terms, you actually lost purchasing power. And there's many times in the 70s, if you look at housing, where the same thing happened, where the rate of inflation went up faster than the overall housing market. Although the housing market went up in nominal terms, you lost real purchasing power. So that's why I think it's so crucial for people to compartmentalize the real return versus a nominal return.
Absolutely. The only thing I want to add to that, George, and that's excellent, is that most of the people in the housing market, even in the 70s, had leverage in there. So the leverage amplifies that return. So nominally, you're right. You know, I think the worst year of inflation, according to the official stats, which are always understated, in the 70s was, I think, 13.5%.
Yeah,
I think that was
right.
The worst year. And so if you have housing going up at 13.5 and inflation at 13.5, your net is zero, right? But if you're leveraged and say you have 50% leverage, hopefully you'd have more than that. You'd have like 80% leverage. You know, you've got a 2-to-1 thing going on,
right? That's right.
So you're really getting 26% on the real estate and inflation's 13.5. You're 27 actually.
Yeah.
So you're protecting yourself with the leverage.
Yeah. You're talking about your cost basis, right? Because let's say you got a $100,000 home, but your cost basis is only 20,000. And it goes up by 10% in nominal terms. Well, now the house would be worth $110,000, which if you would have paid $100,000 for the house, you wouldn't have a gain in real terms, but your cost base is only 20 grand. So since it went up 50% relative to that 20 grand, then you actually do increase your purchasing power. Yeah, that's a very good point.
Income property is the most debt-friendly asset in America.
Yeah.
In other countries, it varies.
Yeah.
And that debt can really protect you from inflation. It gives you tax benefits. It can protect you from natural disaster. It's
if you do it the right way.
Yeah, you got to be careful with it, but it's counterintuitive a lot of ways.
You gotta have enough skin in the game. Yeah. You gotta have positive cash flow. There's a lot of things. You can't just say debt is good, but if you know how to use it, then it's definitely beneficial. That's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, Ike, thank you very much for the super chat, my friend. I see you here all the time. Will the next Great Recession begin overseas and lead people flocking towards the U.S. because of foreign currency, because foreign currency is backed by USD. Schiff versus Johnson.
Coronavirus is a wild card in that, obviously.
Yeah, it sure is.
And the trade war would be another big one.
Yeah, so really what your question revolves around is Johnson thinks that the U.S. market and the dollar will be propped up by a flight to safety. And because we're the cleanest dirty shirt in the hamper, that is going to prop the dollar and other dollar denominated assets up, where Schiff thinks that the dollar is going straight down because he thinks the Fed will print enough money to overpower that cross current that Johnson is talking about. I want to be clear that both of these guys think that in the long run, the dollar is going much, much, much lower. It's just a matter of what is it doing in the short term to midterm. So those are the two cross currents. So you have to understand those arguments. And I've got a few videos on those, and I'll be doing more in the future on this specifically. Also, I'd put Jeff Snyder's view of the dollar funding markets and that creating dollar demand and demand for treasuries, keeping the middle of the yield curve low. And I'll be doing a video on that probably sometime this week. But that's what you have to understand and then come to your own conclusion on what you think has the greatest probability of coming to fruition. Because regardless of how smart Schiff is or Brent or Rickards or Gunlocks, Druckenmiller, any of these guys or girls, it's not a certainty. We're not talking about this has a 100% chance of happening. It's on a spectrum of 0 to 100%. So you could say, all right, I see Schiff's point, and he definitely has one, which Brent would acknowledge, but I see that as maybe a 40% probability, where Brent, I totally get that, and I think there's probably a 60%, then you've got to adjust what you're doing according to that. But understand it's always various shades of gray.
Can I make a comment?
Yeah.
Okay, so here's my macro comment on that. Look, I've been following these guys for years. I remember back in the 70s, you had Howard Ruff, who's been on my podcast. I believe he passed away, and Peter Schiff's been on. And, all of these guys, what I think they're too stuck on, George? They're stuck on the math. And I think there's way more to it than the math, as we both know, right? The U.S. has the reserve currency. I think it's got the military to keep the reserve currency for an awfully long time.
Yeah, I got a counterpoint to that.
Okay, counterpoint me. Hey, listen, that's why we're here. Let's disagree, okay? The other thing, besides the U.S. having the biggest military the human race has ever known, okay, and that's why it can keep that reserve currency status, okay, if it has to. The other thing is, it's got the biggest brand the world has ever known.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been known as the Brinks truck of the world for so long, I mean, you see everybody's talking about, oh, China, and this is before the coronavirus and the trade war. China's going to take over the world, blah, blah, blah. Well, China has a demographic problem that's going to hit it in about 10 to 15 years because the one-child policy. Chinese are parking their money in the U.S. I mean, I don't know. I think this doom and gloom sells a lot of books always, but.
Yeah, so you'd side with Johnson.
Yeah, I guess.
I'd side with
myself, but I think Peter Schiff he sounds great on sound bites, but his stuff never comes true.
Well, it came true in 2009.
Yeah, some of it does, but you got to remember, people that prognosticate always cherry pick their own predictions, okay? And they brag about the ones that came true, and they completely sweep under the rug all the ones that didn't.
Yeah, but you got to look at all of his predictions.
Yeah.
I think you're isolating just the prediction of the dollar going down.
Okay.
Like as an example, he said that the Fed would never stop QE.
Right.
He said it would be QE infinity.
Okay.
And he said as soon as they started to increase interest rates, they could only get to a certain point where they'd have to drop those rates lower because once he called it the Roach Motel.
Right.
That once you enter, you just cannot leave.
Yeah.
And that's
true. It's a cycle. It's terrible.
Yeah.
You can't kick the can down the road.
That's a prediction,
forever.
And he nailed that one.
Okay, fine. But the concept is you can't kick the can down forever, right? You can't kick it down the road forever.
No, the concept is
chickens come home to roost.
With that is once you start quantitative easing and printing money, especially QE, you can't stop.
Got it. The question is, though, maybe the real question is, how far can it go? And nobody knows the answer to that. Mm-hmm. Can they kick the can down the road another 100 years? You know, maybe it's, you know, everybody thinks, though, oh, the world's going to end. I mean, listen to Rickards too, right? 5 years, you know, 10 years, 20 years, it's all going to collapse. Maybe, but maybe we're in, they can just kick it down the road forever. I don't know. How long can it go? Nobody knows the answer to that.
Well, if they can kick it, let's take that, unpack that.
Yeah.
If they can kick it down the road forever, that means that currency in and of itself has consumption power.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning that you don't need to produce to consume.
Yep. MMT type concept, right?
Yeah. So that would mean that you don't have to produce wheat. You don't have to produce corn. You don't have to produce soybeans. You know, going mm-hmm. back to my, that's the example.
In your great whiteboard. Yeah.
In my whiteboard videos. That would mean that we don't need to produce things mm-hmm. to consume.
Right.
I don't think that's going to happen.
What does happen is you slowly get into this, and we're seeing it now, and it's going to get worse, probably. You get into this anemic, watered-down economy, right? The more you abuse the monetary system as it's being abused and has been abused, you just water it all down. And it's like the drug addict that has to have more, a bigger and bigger fix every time. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to have more and more coffee to wake up. And right. It just gets worse and worse and worse. The only problem is we don't know when it has to end. Definitely has to end someday. When?
Right. Well, that's why you have to look at probabilities and you have to adjust your portfolio. And that's a good reason why you can't. The first question that you always have to ask when you're investing or speculating or doing anything is, you can't say, is the price going up or down?
Right.
Like if I look at the dollar
the
right
George
now.
George question, is it cheap?
That's right. Yeah. So if I look at that same question that Brent poses or that Peter poses, is the dollar going down or is it going up? I don't know. So I'm not starting there. What I'm doing is I'm asking myself, is the dollar cheap right now mm-hmm. or is it expensive? Well, it's kind of neither. It's kind of in the middle. So I'm not interested. I'm only looking to buy things that are really, really cheap. And the only thing denominated in dollars that is cheap is, of course, debt. You could argue cash flow as well. So that's the main takeaway here, guys. Jason and I are going to disagree on a few things. We're going to agree on a few things. But as long as you are starting from a standpoint of asking yourself what's cheap and what's expensive and not what is going up or down, regardless of whether it's housing, the dollar, stocks, bonds, you're going to be starting from the right spot.
I agree.
The probabilities are going to be on your side. And over the long run, you're going to make money.
The what's going up or down question is too speculative. But by the way, you see these comments, they like that we're arguing. Let's keep arguing.
All right. So let's go. We're getting way behind on these super chats here. Okay. So we got that one out. Tony, thank you for the super chat. 35 now. Excuse me, seems 100 cases is around where they start quarantine. Oh, we're talking about the coronavirus or the cerveza sickness. We get demonetized.
So
you've already,
it's like Corona beer. We got it.
Yeah. Okay.
Sorry, YouTube.
He's already screwed me. This thing's not going to get demonetized. God. Damn it. You have to buy me dinner for that.
I mean, this is the problem with big tech. They make up rules. You don't even know what the rules are, but you have to follow them.
All right, getting back, getting way off track here. No work, no income, no house payments. Will that make real estate go down in price? Yeah, I mean,
probably.
Yeah. That's why you want 10% gold. That might not hedge your entire downside there, but if we have that type of scenario in the United States, gold is going to go really, really high. And, if everything freezes down, you go into lockdown, that's going to crush real estate. It's going to crush stocks. That's a bad,
George,
bad situation.
What do you like better, gold or silver?
Well, for what's my objective?
Well, insurance.
Gold.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Even though it's not industrial.
Yeah, so I like
silver. And it's a barbarous relic.
Yeah, right.
I'm joking, by the way.
Right. But that shows his macro. He knows Keynes.
Yes, I know. And I know Alan Greenspan.
Yeah, I know the speculation. I like silver a little bit better because of the ratio. Uh-huh. That gold to silver ratio is really out of
whack
right
favorable,
now.
Much more favorable,
yeah. But for insurance, for me, it's always physical gold. And physical gold, too, by the way. Some people look at the
ETF. And what do you like St. Gaudens? Do you like little bars? What do you, you know, just any specifics on the physical?
Yeah, I think the coins is where most people should start. I think that's the best way. It depends on how much you got. All right. KTID asks, what's the best way to buy $100,000 worth of gold?
Oh, I saw that one. Yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah.
Should I be concerned about the bank when withdrawing cash? Well, first of all,
yes.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. If you go to the bank and ask them for $100,000,
they're going to call the police.
Yeah. Have fun with that. Yeah. That you're really going to see if your deposit is actually yours, you're going to get a rude awakening with that one. Yeah,
probably.
I could tell you some stories and we don't have time for that now, but that's, you're going to have to give them advance. Hopefully, you know, your bank, if you know them well, that'll be a lot easier. But if you're with like Wells or B of A,
they're going to freak out.
Yeah, they are. But okay, so the main question, should I be concerned? Yeah, that for sure.
How do you buy the gold?
100, it depends on what you're worried about. Like if you're worried about confiscation, you might want to have some of that in jewelry. If you want to bury it in your backyard, you might want to have bars. If you're more, you think that it's really going to get bad, you might want to use the coins, you have it more divisible. It all depends on what your objectives are. And I think that said, for the storage, if you want to do that, I totally agree with Rick Rule in the sense that you might want to diversify your storage options as far as your political risk. I know Australia, people look at the Perth Mint, but as you guys know from watching my videos, they've confiscated gold in the past, the US and the UK. So I think it would be wise to diversify if you're going to store it. Personally, I like to keep it stored in my, just in my own way, but
can I make a comment on that? Yeah. So, you know, my grandfather was a coin. I mean, he was a farmer with a fourth grade education, but, you know, he did accumulate some wealth over his lifetime and had some real estate deals, and he had a big coin collection and he used to talk about it.
Yeah.
First of all, don't talk about this stuff to anybody. He had a home invasion robbery. They tied him up, and my grandmother, they tied him up. They took the coins and left. And, you know, the dog came at them. They hit them over the head. He had all sorts of guns all over the house. You know, they just took the gun out of his hand. And,
wow.
You know, and they could have been killed, you know.
All right. So all my gold is in the Perth Mint.
Yeah. Yeah.
Moving on.
But wait, one thing about that. Look at, isn't it, if you buy metals and store them in the Perth Mint or in Jersey or in all these places, right? Aren't you just basically buying fiat money? I mean, that's just, how do you really know it's there? How do you know it's yours? How do you ever get it if you have to? I don't know. That seems kind of fiat to me. If I'm going to have precious metals, I want to take possession. No?
I completely agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if it's fiat, but I agree.
Well, they give you a receipt and say you have it.
It's I totally agree that if I've got something, if I've got physical, I'd much rather be in control of it.
Just don't keep it in your house.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Conrad, thank you for the super chat. Do you think HR will be safe industry in the crash? Gosh, I hate HR. Ugh.
You mean human resources?
Yeah. I'm assuming that's the question. Okay. I don't think so. Now I'm looking at this from a standpoint of an entrepreneur who has grown companies large enough to actually have an HR department. Usually that's when I like to check
out.
You
keep your salespeople and your engineers, right? And, you know, like if you were a software company.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, yeah.
But you keep the salespeople.
The HR people are the first people to go.
Yeah. And maybe the advertising and marketing.
Yeah. So I don't think that would be a safe industry in a crash. Lily, thank you for the super chat. My bank asked, would I like to change my mortgage variable rate of 3.7 to a fixed 5-year rate of 2.9? Why, yes. Yes, I would. Okay.
Yeah, do it. But why can't you get a 30-year fix? Are
because
you in
she's
Canada
in the UK.
Or something? Oh, UK, yeah. Yep. Get it fixed for 5 years, I'd say, wouldn't you?
I'd try to fix it as long as I could.
As long as you can.
For sure. Victor, thank you for the super chat. Says, hello, gentlemen. I think that might be a stretch for you. Sorry, I couldn't resist. All right, please discuss the difference between REITs and owning real estate. Also, is it true that real estate investors don't pay taxes? Because I've met some who do. I find it a bit hard to believe. Thank you. Okay. So do you want to start with that?
Sure. Yeah. A REIT is a real estate investment trust, and that's essentially a fund that you put money into. It's got some different rules than other types of real estate ownerships. But, you know, I believe in being a direct investor. So when I invest in something, I want to own it, control it, and not have a middleman in there skimming all the money off the top, mm-hmm. like the Wall Street folks and the REITs, you know, do, and through management fees and so forth. Sometimes they do it illegally, but mostly legally, just through fees. They have a lot of fees on there. And so that's the first thing. And what's the rest of it?
Is it true real estate investors don't pay taxes?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, that's a weird question because it depends. I mean, how much income do you make versus how much tax shelter do you have? Income property is a fantastic tax shelter, but you've got to own enough of it to shelter your income if you have a high income. And if you have a high income, your depreciation deduction phases out unless you become what's called a real estate professional.
Right.
I can talk for a half hour on this, folks, but the basic idea is when you buy a property, you're buying two components. I did a video with George previously on this. The land, which is not depreciable, and the structure, the house or the apartment building sitting on the land, which is depreciable and gives you a fantastic write-off if you can qualify for it. Mm-hmm. And if you own enough of it, yes, you can shelter a very high income if you've got enough income property.
I can qualify for that because that's kind of the main thing that I do now.
Right, right.
And I think what you're probably asking, Victor, and what might make more sense is, and to Jason's point, is your buddies who are paying taxes might not qualify for that. And maybe some of your buddies that do qualify as a real estate professional.
They might make too much money versus the amount of real estate they own.
That too, yeah. But on paper, what can happen is you've got positive cash flow coming in from the rent,
right,
and it depreciates at the same rate, so it's a wash.
Yeah, you can wash out a lot of your income, but if you make a lot of income, then you got to own a lot of property to offset it.
Yeah. Okay, Conrad, thank you for the super chat again. My goodness, Conrad. Thank you very much. Very, very generous of you. How to find safer banks that won't blow up? Okay, so I'll take this. I'm assuming you're in the States, Conrad. I suggest having two options. Number one would be with a big bank like a Wells Fargo, because I hate to say it, but if they're going to bail them out, they're probably going to bail out a huge bank like that because of the systemic risk. But additionally,
Wells Fargo has a scandal every month.
I know.
They just got a $300 billion fine. You see that?
But I would also have a local community bank. And especially if you know someone there. And I always use my relationship that I have with my bank in Kansas City. I won't mention the name, but I know the VP of commercial lending personally.
You can text him.
Yeah, I do quite often if I have a problem. He knows that well. Yeah. So if you have that, then it's an awesome kind of hedge against that type of risk. And what I did with my buddy when I first considered using their bank is he just opened up his books to a certain extent. I said, what was your loan portfolio? What did it do back in the crash? And because they keep all of their loans on their books, which is rare, you know, they're not flipping their loans to Fannie and Freddie. And, you know, they had like a 3% default rate, something like that, mm-hmm. throughout the crash. That's phenomenal.
Yeah.
That means that they're doing very prudent lending.
Right. Because they're keeping them in their portfolio.
That's right.
So they actually care versus the bigger banking system that just sells the loans off.
The
Great Recession, the mortgage meltdown, most of that really was to blame of there's no one there putting on the brakes. There was no one there incentivized to be cautious,
right?
Because you could just transfer the risk to somebody else.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
So that would be my suggestion, especially if you have a local community bank where you know someone kind of at the top and you can understand how they look at risk in their own portfolio. And if they're keeping that debt on their books, then and then I'd kind of split it between the two. So you've got as much of a hedge as you possibly can. But remember, guys, when you're with any bank, make sure that you really think twice about those vehicles that they offer that offer you a higher interest rate, such as a money market fund or anything like that. Because if they're giving you a higher interest rate, that means they're taking a lot more risk with that money. A lot of times they could be putting it into the repo market, as an example. So you know, I always say, would you want to loan Deutsche Bank your money in a term repo?
Yeah.
My guess is probably no. And so keep in mind that is a possibility with some of those instruments that banks offer that pay you additional interest.
Money market's not FDIC insured. And George, I got to ask you, what do you think about credit unions?
I think it's the same type of thing that if you know someone there and you understand how they operate, then it's a good option. But I wouldn't have all my eggs in one basket.
No matter what.
I'd have a big, huge bank.
Yeah.
Just for the reasons we discussed, and then a smaller entity. Okay. Pat, thank you for the super chat. Macro-ish question. Inflation, deflation. Jury is out. Which will happen? But talk about deflation and real estate. Advice to survive, thrive in that type of situation. So a deflationary environment. And I want to point out that There's a couple different types of deflation. So we could have asset deflation, like we had back in 2009 or to 2012 in real estate specifically. But remember, the CPI still went up. So we had asset deflation while we had consumer price inflation. That's probably more likely as opposed to going back to like the 1930s where we have asset deflation and price deflation. But I think that's a fantastic question. If we did go through a 1930s type of situation, what would that do to a real estate investor?
Well, that's kind of an all bets are off type situation.
Yeah.
Now, remember, the banking laws and the foreclosure laws were very different as we got into the Great Depression, you know, and that was obviously decades and decades ago. You know, you're probably going to get hurt. I mean, the question is, how much are you going to get hurt?
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, the deflation of the price doesn't scare me very much because I'm a yield investor.
Right.
Like you, I like those linear markets. You still, you know, if you have deflation, your operating expenses would decline.
Yeah, I was going to say your property taxes go down.
Your property taxes would decline. But the scary part is maybe your rents would decline too.
Right. And therefore your mortgage would be more.
Yeah, well, your mortgage would be more burdensome. I'm not worried about that because, frankly, I know there'd just be a bailout and everybody would start walking away doing strategic defaults and the lenders would do workouts just like they did the last time during the Great Recession, not the Great Depression. So I'm not too scared of that one because you always have that nuclear option, as I call it, the strategic default that
millions of people
took advantage of. Yeah, rents, that does concern me. But again, you know, the economy always trickles up or trickles down. During the Great Recession, virtually every contract in the world was getting renegotiated.
Right.
So when your rents decline, you go to your lender and say, look, I can't afford to keep this property. Help me out. And they give you a loan modification. They do a workout. They help you with a short sale or whatever. So it's always good to have a good amount of leverage on those properties, because then you've got a partner by default. Your lender becomes your partner.
Yeah.
And they'll work with you.
Yeah. One thing I also want to point out, that going back to 2009, when we had that asset deflation, rents actually went up. Now granted, and I always say it was a stipulation, that although that would put short-term pressure on rent, so if we do have a recovery, you're not going to see too much downside. If we had like a 10-year depression, I always tell people that I think people in general would change their behavior patterns. Mm-hmm. So there'd be more people living in less square footage, and that would potentially put pressure on rents.
And they'd roommate up.
Exactly.
And all that kind of stuff. And you're right. The rents ultimately did go up during the Great Recession. But for a while, the damn government distorted the market, right? Because in the 2008 presidential campaign, you know, the talk from every politician was, we got to keep people in their houses. We got to keep people. And, you know, a lot of people were in houses they should have never been able to buy, couldn't afford. They were living in luxury, but keep them in the houses. So they would put pressure on the banks to do the workouts, and the people would sit there and live mortgage payment free for a year, 2 years, 3 years.
Yeah.
So the government once again distorted the market.
Right.
But
right.
the principle you're saying is absolutely correct.
Yeah.
When people can't buy or won't buy, it puts upward pressure on rents, no question.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's a great way to look at it. Let's see, was that was Pat. Yeah, that's a great way to look at it, Pat. And I like the way you're thinking, because you're trying to weigh all the options and try to analyze what would happen and then go through probabilities. So I think the your framework for how you're thinking about it is spot on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, Ben, thank you for the super chat. What is your thought on real estate syndications and REITs? I think we touched on REITs, but maybe syndications.
Yep.
Should I stay away, or do they serve a purpose in a portfolio?
Of my 10 commandments of successful investing, number 3 is thou shalt maintain control. And that means I believe you should be a direct investor, buy properties that you own, you control, you decide what to buy, where to buy, when to buy, when to refinance, who to rent it to, how much to rent it for. And you don't have some syndicator or fund manager or any middleman in there who can skim all the profits off the top, or worse yet,
or make
be
bad
a crook
management decisions
and cheat you. Yeah. So if you don't maintain control of your investments, if you don't follow commandment number 3, 3 possible problems ensue. Number 1, you might be investing with a crook.
Right.
Number 2, you might be investing with an idiot. Okay. Right. Like you just said. Number 3, assuming they're honest and competent, they take a management fee off the top for managing the deal. So I say just own directly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Nazik, thank you for the super chat. Please, can you comment or host a long session on real estate investing environment if Bernie Sanders comes into power? I think, yeah, that is a whole video in and of itself. But on that note, Nazik, I think what we could go over briefly is probably rent control and how that what that does. Yeah, so what are your opinions on rent control?
Well, it's a disaster. I'm sure you'll agree. It's never worked anywhere or at any place in any time in history or any place on earth. It's a mess, and it's a bad deal. And
it's
it
a mess because
from an
econ standpoint, from a macro, it just creates less supply.
I mean, what's the incentive to invest if the government's going to get in the middle of your transaction and tell you can't raise the rent? It distorts markets. And you know, earlier we were talking when you were on my show about the velocity of money.
Right, right.
And interestingly, rent control just kills velocity.
Right, right.
I had the velocity
of the transaction.
Yeah, I did that show where my video editor was on my podcast talk, and he's in that rent control department in San Francisco.
Right, right, right.
Wants to move. He and his wife want to move, but their deal is so good they can't duplicate it, so they can't move. They're stuck in that house that they're paying $2,400 a month for a $1.7 million place in San Francisco. Right. And, you know, their landlord won't fix it up. There's no incentive to fix it up.
Yeah.
So the house goes into disrepair.
Yeah.
Everybody, the market becomes stagnant. It's a terrible deal.
Yeah.
In every way.
Yeah. But it is something that you should think about as a real estate investor. And I'm not sure if he'd have the power to do that on a nationwide level. But that's why you need to be diversified. And that's why going back to I don't have 10 commandments yet, but I do have 3.
You three and
I have
a stiff
3.
Drink.
Yeah. And as you guys recall, we talked about it earlier, but you got to buy things cheap, sell them when they're expensive. You've got to, with an investment, it's got to pay you to own it. And then diversification, and including diversify your political risk and your currency risk. And I think that that's why I have properties in the United States. It's also why I have properties here in Colombia, and why I'm very open to buying properties in other places in the world. It can get tricky, and I don't want to say that that's like a panacea, because it's not. You really got to know your stuff. You really got to know the property management. You can't use leverage. There's a lot of pros and cons that
outside of the U.S.
Outside of the U.S., But it is a great way to diversify that political risk in case of this type of situation. Yeah.
And you know, if rent control, you know, if you did get Bernie and socialism and rent control become the thing, you're going to have some time to react. It's not like that would happen overnight. That's got to go through Congress. There's going to be all kinds of lobbyists and opposition. So I wouldn't worry about something like that too much.
I just stick with it. As long as you're using those rules, and then you're, I think it, helps you be more prepared for anything that that comes along, whether it's some black swan event like the Cerveza sickness or anything. Okay. Same shirt, different day. Thank you again for the super chat. First time real estate buyer, land in Colorado or house in Denver? House in Denver.
House in Denver, easy. Yeah.
No brainer. Okay. Now, I don't really like Denver, but I like a house every time over land because it produces cash flow. Yeah. It's far more liquid. It produces cash flow, pays you to own it. Land is very speculative, very illiquid. So, yeah.
My definition of an investment, and George, you've heard me say this, if it doesn't produce income, it is not an investment. It is only a speculation.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
so
we definitely agree on that.
You got to have income or you're not investing. You can speculate. Sure, that's okay. If you've got the money and you can afford to lose it, speculate all you want. But if it does, you're not investing if you don't have income.
Yeah. Okay, Boogie Boogie, thank you for the super chat. I think he's just reminding everyone, this is a great point, that China is out of work till March 12th. And that, from a macro standpoint, that means supply chain disruption. And taking a step further, that means potentially future inflation with that supply, with those disruptions in the supply chains. Conrad, thank you for the super chat. Says Zima sniffles.
What is that?
That's his.
I love these screen names. They're great.
No. That's Zima, like an alcohol.
You're right.
And
yeah,
sniffles,
I remember
like the
Zima.
Flu. So instead of the Cerveza sickness, it's the Zima. Okay, Zima. In Iran, economic U.S. outlook. Well, for Iran specifically, it's not as bad as China, but. Well, let me think this through, but actually in a way it is because
sanctions.
No, because I'm thinking just a matter of fear. People think that if this doesn't come to the United States, it's not going to affect the U.S. economy. That is not true because the more fear, it'll lock up it'll make people, it'll create an environment where they're a lot more concerned about risk. And that could definitely affect the U.S. stock market. It could affect housing. Even if it doesn't come to the U.S., if it starts to really get bad, that shuts down flights. There's so many knock-on effects that you have to pay attention to this stuff. And I've been saying this for quite a while, and I want to give a shout-out to my buddy Eric Townsend, who came on and did my show a couple weeks ago and really talked about the details. And he had Chris Martinson on his podcast talking about this. And those guys caught a lot of flack. 3 weeks ago about being alarmists and all this. And now we're seeing, especially over the weekend, that a lot of that concern was justified. Now, I'm not saying that you need to be scared or that you should lose sleep over this, but I do think you should be cognizant of what is going on and just look at the numbers. And Eric makes a great point that the market isn't even paying attention to this. They're looking at this as a non-event. So your asymmetry on that is quite substantial. And hopefully this will phase out. But if it doesn't, it's going to have some big ramifications on the U.S. asset prices and the economy. Let me back up here, Conrad, because you know what, though? It definitely would have an impact on the economy and asset prices. But keep in mind, the Fed could come in and produce a lot more liquidity that could raise those asset prices, so especially stocks. So I want to be more careful in that answer and say that although that's what should happen from a macro standpoint, fundamentally, they could print all this money and it could be this thing that the market sees that it sees horrible news as good news because that means more liquidity, asset prices go up. So you've got to be aware of those two cross currents at play there.
Right. Good point, because post 9/11, everybody thought, oh, that's terrible. The world's going to end, but they just pumped the money. And, you know, of course, we saw what happened to stocks and real estate post 9/11.
Yeah, but you know how much money they pumped in the system back then?
I don't remember. But
yeah, this is a great point, guys. Yeah. So if
the interest rates just plummeted, I mean.
Yeah, so I've used this chart quite a few times, but if you haven't seen one of these videos, Jason brings up a really great point. Think about this, guys. Back then, when they injected all that money into the system for 2011 to try to paper that over, they injected about around $60 billion. And if you look at a chart of excess reserves in the banking 9/11 system.
Okay, so 2001.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, got it.
Yeah, I might have misspoke there. Sorry, I'm talking about 9/11, 2001.
Right. Okay.
So the excess reserves in the banking system got up to $60 billion, 6-0.
Got it.
The banking reserves now are at $1.5 trillion.
Yeah, quite a difference.
Right, so my point is liquidity. It's all relative. Yeah. Excess liquidity. Right. Yeah. What that $60 billion, the Fed's pumping that into the repo market nightly. Where back, that's what we used to do. And this catastrophe that the US has never seen in the form of these terrorist attacks. So it goes back to what Jim Grant always says, and that the Fed has created this financial hall of mirrors. Yeah. Because there's so much QE, so much money printing, interest rates are distorted so heavily that it's almost impossible to know what's going on or what will go on from a fundamental standpoint. That's really my point. Okay, so moving on. Tony, thank you for the super chat. All in gold and silver. I know your thoughts. It's good, Tony. I'm glad you've been paying attention. My gold increases 300 per ounce. I have 160 ounces, not including 600 silver. Okay. I feel I'm doing well. You're doing well. I started 8 years ago. Listen, Tony, you've definitely crushed it on your gains. But let's remember that if Jason and I are at the blackjack table and we are both sitting on a 19, and let's say Jason decides to hit.
I wouldn't be deciding to hit. That'd be you. You're the speculator.
All right. But you decide to hit. And let's say Jason gets a two. And before he gets that, I say, no, Jason, you don't want to hit. I'm going to stay because the probabilities say that you should stay on a 19. And he says, oh, forget that. I don't buy that. I'm going to hit. He gets a two and gets 21. He wins. Let's say I lose. Let's say the dealer gets 20. And then he looks at me and says, see, if I would have taken your advice, then I would not have had this gain. So then the question becomes, who did the right thing? Mm-hmm. Did Jason do the right thing? Or did I do the right thing? Some people would say Jason did because he won and I lost. But others, like me, would say that George actually did the right thing because over the long run,
George is going to,
by making those decisions, right, you're going to come out ahead. So that's why I go back to this. And listen, I love gold. I love silver. But I don't love having 100% of your portfolio in it because over the long run, that's not a good probabilistic decision. And but of course you did make money, and congratulations to you for that. So all right, Ben, thank you for the super chat. It says, George, do you think buying stocks in a company like Berkshire Hathaway is a speculation?
Oh yeah, I wanted to hear your answer. I saw that before.
Since they do not pay a dividend. Yes, I do. I think there is, although they use their dividends or their cash flow well. So Buffett doesn't really like paying dividends too much because you get taxed on it. So if he's got a good company where they could reinvest that money back into the company and grow the company by that much, if not more, you're growing the company tax-free to the investors or to the shareholders. So I like that. But in this market where the CAPE ratio is at 30, anything that's not paying you to own it, it's definitely a speculation.
What do you think about Berkshire post Warren Buffett? He's got to retire soon. I mean, he cannot be doing this forever. He's getting up there.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of like the Steve Jobs thing.
Right.
I don't know. That's a good question. I haven't given that too much thought, to be honest with you. Okay. Ryan, thank you for the super chat. I have a large amount of money in gold call options. If HSBC collapses, or GLD call options, okay, if HSBC collapses, will a good hedge be buying far out of the money puts in gold? Okay, Ryan, I think this is a very interesting way to play things if you know what you're doing. I would not advise this for the average Joe. But what this might be a cop out, but what I'm going to tell you is I'm actually interviewing. I'm doing a four-part series. And I don't even know if I've let everyone know this. But I'm doing a 4-part instructional series with Patrick Serezna from Macro Voices. So most of you, I'm sure, listen to Macro Voices. You're familiar with who Patrick is. He is an options expert. And we're going to do this 4-part instructional series where we go over the very, very basics and then kind of gradually progress. And I'm not saying everyone should do this. I don't think it's right. I think it's right for very few people, but it could be an interesting way to do it. And so to answer this question, I'm going to suggest that you watch that 4-part series with Patrick that's coming up, because he is a pro and he's going to walk you right through it. Okay, Cloud TNT, thank you for the super chat. Should we wait to invest for the housing bubble to pop? Okay, this goes back to what we're saying before. What you're doing, Cloud TNT, is you're asking yourself the wrong question. You're asking yourself, are prices going up or are they going down? Now, I agree, that definitely does matter, but that's not your starting point. So you've got to ask yourself, okay, can I buy that cash flow cheap? Is that debt cheap? And then if you come to the conclusion that it is, then you've got to ask yourself, what's the way to play that with the least amount of downside? And that's where, you know, Jason and I both, you guys have heard it a million times, where we talk about linear markets. And I think Jason would agree. These linear markets, they're not cheap. I would argue that the prices are inflated there as well, but they're just less inflated.
A lot less inflated than
the coastal markets in all these areas where I would suggest that prices are in a bubble. But I think it's good to have some dry powder for sure as part of your portfolio. But if you could find an opportunity to buy a fourplex or something where you're getting a point, I like a 1% RV ratio. If that was possible and you could do that with 30-year fixed rate debt, I would go ahead and pull the trigger on that, assuming that you've got enough in reserve, assuming that it's, you're not stretching yourself too much financially. I would definitely do that, even if I thought prices were going down in the future, because you're not planning on selling. So, all right, next question here. Federal Reserve has committed, I'm not sure if that's the person's, I think that is their username. Okay. I said Federal Reserve has committed treason.
Oh, that's their name. That's their username. Okay. Yeah, love it. Love it. Good username.
Yeah. I think everyone should invest in tar and feathers for the tax man. Okay, well, I don't condone any type of violence. Let me be clear with that.
Oh, it's just tarring and feathering. It's not violence.
Yeah. But I do think the Federal Reserve is the root of a lot of our problems. And if we didn't have a centralized power in banking, and if we had a way to cap or limit the supply of currency, that most of the big problems that we have right now would not have. And that goes for a lot of the poverty. That goes for the asset bubbles. It's just going on down the line. And if you guys want more info on that, I did a video on deflation. It wasn't on deflation, but I talked about deflation from 1800 to 1900. And I use the example of someone working at McDonald's. So and how their standard of living would increase substantially, even if they didn't get a raise at their job. So check out that video.
Okay. And interestingly, one of the Fed's original mandates
was
price stability to stop this roller coaster bubble cycle.
Yeah, but now they just redefined price stability as prices going up.
Yeah. Ridiculous. You can't make this stuff.
Okay, Ira, thank you for the super chat. Was ending the gold standard basically the equivalent of the U.S. government stealing all the gold from the American people? Well, I don't know that I would take it literally like that, but I would suggest that inflation has stolen a lot of wealth from the American people.
Yep.
Going back to that deflation argument that I was making earlier, and I made on that video, since the Federal Reserve has come into existence, we've had over 2,000% inflation. So
the dollar's worth about 3 or 4 cents, right?
98% of the dollar's value has evaporated.
Two cents then. Yeah.
So that's taking away purchasing power from savers, especially, which is what we want to promote. And even now, if we don't have a lot of what they would claim to be inflation, if we had negative real rates, you're still have that effect where you're losing purchasing power with your savings. So especially when you look at deflation. So let's go back to that. Between 1800 and 1900, prices in the United States went down by 50%, 50. So let's just say that you had $100,000 in savings in the year 1800, and that gets passed on down the line to generation, and it's growing and making interest, because remember, we had positive real rates, positive nominal rates at about 4% throughout that same time frame. So that money's growing. And then by the time that person of that generation gets it at the year 1900, think of how much more purchasing power. So with deflation, it's adding to the purchasing power of the people, of the average Joe, and it's adding to their wealth, where inflation does the complete opposite. Inflation just adds purchasing power to the people that own assets.
With
so,
debt.
So that's the 1%. No, just even if they own assets.
Right.
It's so that's going to the 1%. That's why you have such a discrepancy between the haves and the have-nots. Yeah. That's a result of inflation and money printing. We've got to remember that.
So, George, here's the thing, though. If, you know, that deflation, it's good on that respect that you mentioned, but everybody just puts off purchasing decisions.
No, that's nonsense.
To wait. No, you think so?
Nonsense. No? Credit card.
Okay. So what do you mean?
Okay. So what I mean by that is a credit card is someone saying that they want to pay more for something right now than they would in the future.
Okay.
So that whole deflation argument, like people aren't going to buy something now because they can get it cheaper in the future.
Yeah.
If that were true, people wouldn't use credit cards.
Because, the credit card and they're carrying interest on their credit card.
That's right.
Or not? Yeah,
that's right. Because if you're saying right now, let's say credit card interest rates are at 16%.
Right.
And
we just did the video.
That,
on
right.
That, yeah.
So and you're not that you're paying it off every single month.
Right.
Like you would.
Yep.
But if you're someone who's carrying a credit card balance,
sure.
You're saying that I would prefer to buy this at a more expensive price now
right.
than I could get it in the future by saving that money to buy it then, right? So deflation argument
yeah.
is, okay, I'm not going to buy this TV now because I know in a year I can buy it cheaper. Well, if that were true, if people made decisions that mm-hmm. way, credit cards wouldn't exist.
Fair enough. That's a good point. However, I don't think that... people that carry credit card balances are really doing that math.
Yeah. And
they're instant gratification minded and they're not financially
disciplined. But let's go down the list because this is, I think, a problem with modern day economics when they look at deflation. Now, I agree that if you get into a situation where you've got a society that's over leveraged,
right.
Yeah, you can, that there can be bad deflation mm-hmm. there,
yeah.
But I'm talking about good deflation, which happens naturally in a free market economy,
which essentially is good hedonics.
Better.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Right? Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
So you have to ask yourself, okay, what would I not buy or what would most people not buy? So, okay. Gas. Would you not buy gas? Probably not.
You'd buy all the necessities
food.
You need every day.
That's right. Really the only thing that
you might not
buy
the new car or the new TV. Like you said, right?
Oh, no, I think you'd still buy that because
okay.
look, TV, you're going to buy it. TVs. I mean, a year now
mm-hmm.
or a year from now, you're going to be able to buy that same TV
for
much,
less.
Much
right.
cheaper
yeah.
because technology
yeah.
is naturally deflationary,
right. Yeah.
right? Really, the only thing you're not going to buy are assets.
So you're not going to invest.
Right. You're not going to buy stocks. You're not going to buy
right.
a speculative house. And that makes things better.
Well, if it's speculative and you don't buy it, yes, you're right. But investment is good. That's what capital formation is
well,
for. It's for investment.
Well, I'm talking about just investing directly in assets. Now,
right.
if you're investing in like a business to start mm-hmm. a business,
yeah.
but that's not going to be, I mean, you're not going to not start a business that you think is going to be profitable.
Right.
Because for some deflationary reason,
right.
you think
gonna,
it's going to affect demand.
It. Yeah, right.
Yeah. So if you really think through that,
yeah.
I don't think there are many purchases that would really be affected. And then you look at the credit card example, I don't think it is human behavior where the mm-hmm. typical Keynesian
yeah.
will come in and think that if we just have 1% deflation,
mm-hmm.
if prices go down by 1%, it's just the end of the
downward
world.
Downward spiral.
Oh, you're just doomed.
Yeah.
You're doomed.
Yeah.
And I don't see any evidence for that, especially when you look at the 1800s, where we had deflation through the entire 1800s, especially from 1870 to 1913 before they started the Fed.
So that deflation was not a monetary phenomenon. That was an industrialization phenomenon, right?
It was the free market.
Mass they're producing, production got better
they're producing
cheaper.
Things. They're producing better quality goods and services
got better,
at a cheaper price, and it just benefits society. Yeah. Where right now, if we had that, the Fed would freak out and, oh my gosh, the world is coming down. Well, we got to print money.
Their mandate is at least 2% inflation.
Yeah, quick,
right?
Print money. Let's lower rates artificially low. And not only that, another thing, people in the Keynesians make the argument that, well, if we had deflation, then wages would go down. Therefore, there's less demand for consumer goods. That's how they kind of get to this
the spiral concept.
Right. But they don't look at the 1800s. They ignore that because in the 1800s, we had price deflation. Mm-hmm. Wages actually went up.
Yeah, right.
So did nominal GDP. Mm-hmm. So nominal GDP and wages are going up while prices are going down. That means the standard of living is increasing.
Do you know what I've always said about that is that, you know, of course, your listeners and viewers know that the government and the central banks manipulate the inflation rate in three major ways: weighting, hedonics, and substitution. Okay. And hedonics is kind of logical. There's an argument for it, right? I know you'll probably disagree, but let me finish.
Yeah, I do disagree.
Because
to a certain extent.
But hedonic indexing is so unfair because it basically says we as a people are not entitled to progress. Like the progress belongs to the CPI, not the people, you know, because it the way it indexes, it's what you were just saying about the 1800s, you know. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, guys, let's get back to the super chats here. Oh, we are way behind, buddy.
All right, go.
Okay, let's see here.
No
see.
More debates.
Okay, Pat asks, looking into Florida new builds, talk about single family resident versus multifamily. RV ratios seem better on multi. Also, are we nearing peak supply in Northern Florida, in the Northern Florida markets? I mean, I'm sure you got your finger on the pulse here.
I own properties there. Yeah.
Yeah. But remember, we got to keep it as fast as we can here.
Okay, so single family versus multifamily. You'll almost always get better looking numbers on a multifamily deal. However, because you have some economies of scale and so forth, and you know the numbers will just be better. But on a multifamily, you don't get the tenant quality. On the single family, you get a better quality tenant by and large. Right. So just look at it this way. If you have an A property, okay, and it's a single family home, you're generally going to get an A tenant. If you have an A property that's a multifamily of any type, you're probably going to get one notch down in the tenant. They're going to be a B tenant.
Okay.
And if it's a B multifamily property, you're going to get a C tenant. But a B single family will get you a B tenant. They'll be at par.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, now, there's exceptions to all those rules because everything's individual. But I like single family the best. Look, I've owned a lot of multifamily units. I own a mobile home park now with a client of mine. And so multifamily is good. It's much more complicated. And when you say multifamily, what are you talking about? Plexes, like duplex, fourplex? Or are you talking about 125 unit apartment complex like I've owned? So it varies.
Okay, so next question is, talk about single family. Okay, RV ratios seem better. Okay. Also, are we nearing peak supply in Northern California?
Northern Florida. I don't know. Northern Florida is a big swath, so I don't know what you mean. You're talking about Pensacola, Escambia County up there. I don't think we're nearing peak supply of entry-level type rental houses almost anywhere, except really blighted markets like Detroit. But no, we do not. There's a huge supply shortage of bread and butter single-family homes. Huge shortage.
All right, Brian, thank you for the super chat. Retired at 44. Good for you, Brian. Good for you, buddy.
Yeah.
48 years old now. Traveled the world. Own one last house in LV. I'm assuming Las Vegas. $275,000. No mortgage. I'm way too lazy
to
get back into rentals.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sitting will lose value. Should I take a loan and buy cash, precious metals? To answer that question well, Brian, I'd have to know your personal situation, what your portfolio looks like right now. I, you know, what's interesting about Vegas is it's not that bad. You would think it would be in a huge bubble like LA, but when you look at the price to income ratios, although it was terrible, as we all know, in the last bubble, it's not horrible, but it's not the greatest market. I think you could use that equity better in different markets. As far as all the other things you add, like what percentage of your portfolio should be in cash, precious metals, other than just my general, what I always say. And one thing I want to add, guys, when I say that you should have 10% in insurance, 80% in investments, and 10% in speculation, I'm not talking about, that doesn't include the portion of your portfolio that you have allocated to cash. And that's different for everybody. So I'm just talking about the amount of your portfolio that you want invested. Now, some people want 50% in cash because they want a lot of dry powder. Some people 10, that all varies. So I want to make sure that I'm specific and people understand that I do think it is a good idea to have some cash. Now, I would argue that the best way to hold that cash is just short-term T-bills and just roll them over every 3 months. So you're letting them expire. So you don't have any risk of them going down in value if interest rates go up and you're getting paid a little bit. And especially compared to like a money market fund with a bank, I would rather have that counterparty risk of the government, believe it or not. I know it's crazy for many to say that, but I think that is your counterparty risk with a T-bill is less than having that or less counterparty risk than having it like a money market fund where, again, they could take that and be lending it into the repo market to Deutsche Bank or HSBC. Yeah, okay. So no more super chats, guys. I really, really, really appreciate it, but it's going to take us quite a while to get through the super chats that we already have. Yeah, so
like someone's asking, what's the quota? So no more today.
Yeah, just because it's going to take us quite a while to get through the ones that we have. So I really appreciate the super chat, guys. It definitely helps out the channel and pay people like Sebastian, who's on here right now.
Yes, he's doing Sebastian a great job. Get paid.
Yeah. Yeah. But I appreciate it, guys. And that's why, I enjoy this anyway, but I really try to answer the questions as thoroughly as I possibly can. Acrobat Mapping asks, late 97, 98 Asia crisis with supply disruption caused supply side inflation. Slow to get to the US, but eventually Greenspan had to raise rates. New supply side disruption in Asia, inflation boogeyman being possible, 100%. And I did a video on that. I know some people were saying in the comments the other day that the CNBC talking heads were saying how that wouldn't be too much of a big deal, but I don't agree. If you watch Peter Buchvar, which I highly recommend, he's on Real Vision all the time. I think he had a report coming out that really kind of debunked that. But the bottom line is that a lot of the supply chains, I would argue maybe even the majority of the supply chains in the entire world start in China. Stuff that you'd never think about. I read a fact the other day where a lot of the Indian pharmaceutical companies actually source their material from China. So this has trickle-down effects or knock-on effects that are tough to even comprehend.
Yeah.
And so, yes, if those supply chains get disrupted, then it is very inflationary because the whole reason they probably started in China is because they could get them cheaper. You got to build more manufacturing. Even if you're a t-shirt company, let's say, and you're getting it sourced in China, now you can just switch it over to call it Mexico. Well, my guess is that you were sourcing it in China because you could get it slightly cheaper than you could have in Mexico. Also, we got to remember that the Chinese buy a lot of treasuries. So that could bump rates on treasuries, although there's a lot of other demand factors there. But my point is there's a lot of variables and a lot of cross currents, but inflation is definitely most probable in my opinion as a result of that. Okay, Miguel, thank you for the super chat. Everyone speaks of dry powder to have ready. Give us a few ideas for the average, let's see, 56 to 95K American.
That's probably income.
Income, okay. With 50 to 75% expenses. Okay, got it. With only 50 to 25% left to invest. Well, I mean, I don't think it changes too much. I'd try to save up, and if you could find some decent cash flow, put down $20,000 or so on a starter home. I think we all know that. I don't want to beat that dead horse.
We've got properties like that.
Yep, jasonhartman.com. I'd have the 10% in gold, I think, is prudent. What I would personally do with that type of income, I would go back to those trucks, something I know well, because I know I could take your income as a side hustle and make $100,000 a year. Easy. And then just take that 100 and let that build up and use that as kind of seed money for the rest of my portfolio. And if you guys want me to, I'm happy to do videos on how to flip trucks or cars or anything like that to just create $100,000 a year side hustle. It's just, I've done a couple of them when I first started the channel and they weren't that popular.
Yeah.
They weren't as popular as like the repo market and the macro stuff. So, but maybe what I'll do is I'll do a side video on that and I'll make that exclusive to the people who are on my email list. So that's a great way for me to plug.
Then it won't dilute.
It's a good transition. Too, yeah. So if you guys aren't on my email list, go to georgegammon.com. The benefit to you is that you will receive future exclusive content that we will not have up on YouTube. But that's probably what I would do personally, Miguel. And to be clear, it doesn't have to be trucks. It's just anything that you know well. I know guys out there making a ton of money on sneakers, art, collectibles. Yeah. You just have to know it extremely well and then understand that arbitrage play and know, or maybe it's a store of value. I still own quite a few of these diesel trucks. In fact, I own over $100,000 of diesel trucks. Yeah.
I had no idea you were into this.
Yeah. That's so funny. And I just keep them in storage up in Arizona, and they're under 100,000 miles. They're 7.3 diesels. And, they're like gold for me.
Just and they're not just like depreciating all the time?
Oh, no, are you kidding me? Really? Oh, absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah, I'll tell you about it at dinner. Yeah, why am I? I'll tell you about it at dinner. Okay, Chadisms, thank you for the super chat. Who are private shareholders in the Fed? Any guesses? Oh, who knows?
Yeah. Rothschilds.
Yeah.
We could tell you that one.
I know you, at some of your live events, you have G.
Edward Griffin has been on my podcast and spoken at our live conferences. By the way, George, should we tell him you're speaking at our next conference? That's exciting. I guess we just did.
Sure. Yeah. So Jason does Meet the Masters events. And I guess I'm one of the masters.
You now. Are, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. At his next event, which, what's the date on that?
May 2nd and 3rd in San Diego, California. And it's Meet the Masters of Income Property.
Okay, cool. Yeah,
San Diego.
Yeah, he wants me to get up on stage and do kind of a whiteboard thing on the CPI. So yes. I'll probably be doing that. So if you want to meet me live, say hello. Check that out. I'm sure they can find information on your website.
It's not up yet because we just booked the date, but jasonhartman.com, it'll be there and I'll announce it on my podcast.
Okay, cool.
When we have a landing page.
Kay Brown, thank you for the super chat. Do you think Trump will bring back the gold standard? No. The opposite of that. Judy Shelton is a gold bug and his appointee for the chair Fed. Do you follow the question? I totally follow the question. Yeah, I get it. Yeah. Like secretly, he wants to go back onto a gold standard. So he's trying to load up people that have that mentality at the Fed. Oh, boy. He'll say that he might do that. But a tweet later, he'll say how he wants negative interest rates and he wants the Fed to print more money.
Would it even be possible to go back on a gold standard?
Yeah.
We're in so deep.
Yeah.
I mean, how much gold would be like $1 million an ounce?
Yeah, you'd have to reprice gold.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's definitely possible. It's definitely possible. Really? Wow. Absolutely, 100%. But I don't know that Trump's a big hard money guy. I don't think so.
Yeah, you gotta look to Ron Paul for that one.
For sure, for sure. Yeah, and to be clear for all my listeners, and you may not know this, but I'm not political at all. But the one thing that I may be political, or one opinion I have that may be political, is I dislike all politicians equally. There you go. Jill, thank you for the super chat. Education is the key. Keep on keeping on. You're doing good work. Love the channel, George. Thank you very much, Jill. I appreciate it. And I totally agree. We've got to educate ourselves. There's no excuse not to. In the age of the internet and all these, YouTube is a great example. What Jason does with his podcast, the Creating Wealth Show, it's there's no excuse. It's free. Yeah. It's out there at your disposal. So just don't have your head buried in the sand. Understand these things. Hopefully I'm making it a little easier for you guys to understand and then make better decisions for your financial future. Chris, thank you for the super chat. Is it a good idea to pull equity out of your home in order to buy rental property?
Yes.
My concern is over leverage since it's basically 100% financing.
Well, Ken, you can't get 100% cash out on a conventional loan or any loan, probably. So I would say that's not going to happen. So you're not in danger of that.
Well, I think he's talking about if you take out equity to buy a rental property.
Oh, then the rental property becomes 100% leverage. Right. That is true. That's a good point. Yeah. Thank you. If you take out $20,000 out of you take $100,000 out of your home and you buy five rental properties with $20,000 down each, those are 100% financed. And I think that's a great deal so long as the loan on your home is a good quality loan and it's not a crappy adjustable rate HELOC that's at a high rate. If you get a good quality loan on that to pull the equity out of your house, I would definitely say to do that. Now, I'm a little more of a leverage hound than you are. You like leverage, but I like it even more.
Yeah,
so, you might disagree with me on the edges. I mean, I know.
Yeah, I think it's really based on your personal situation. Like if you got a lot of money in the bank, if you got a high income, if you've got a lot of cushion there in case we go into a downturn, then I think it's something to consider. If by chance you're just maxing out your leverage, you can barely afford the mortgage. If you didn't have a tenant in there for call it 4 or 5 months, then I don't think that would be a good idea. So
Yeah, 4% minimum cash reserves
on all
the property you own.
Exactly.
So if you're going to own $1 million worth of property, you got to have 40 grand in the bank. Mm-hmm. Okay. And interestingly, and it's kind of a little bit counterintuitive maybe, if you have rental properties and you don't have that 40 grand, I would pull it out of the equity to have the 40 grand in the bank and have control of that money before a possible downturn or a job loss hits, because you're never going to get it out after that happens.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, it's going to be tough.
So get control of the money. I like to have control of the equity outside of the property.
Yeah. Okay, Willie, thank you for the super chat. Is it wise for me to expand my HVAC business in the current economy? That's going to be a very cyclical business right there, I'd assume.
Yeah. So that's air conditioning and heating. And, how much does what we don't know is how much does it cost you to expand that business? I assume like, for example, the installers, are they all freelancers that are just getting a cut of the deal?
Yeah.
Or, you know, the killer of any business, and George and I have a lot of business experience, is fixed cost overhead.
That's right.
So if you got to buy a bunch of new trucks and hire a bunch of employees that are on W-2 that get paid no matter what, I would be very leery.
Yeah, take on additional space in a building or something.
But if that can be variable costs, you know, where...
Yeah, it's like marketing.
Yeah.
If it's like a marketing cost where you're just generating more leads and you're spending a little bit more money there to generate some sales, I'd say for sure, go for it. Because let's strike while the iron's hot. Yeah. And
there's a lot of construction. So if you've got construction contracts from builders, that could be great.
I totally agree with Jason. Yeah. I just wouldn't, if you've got an office, if you have an office yourself, I wouldn't try to take on an additional 10-year lease for another 5,000 square feet or anything like that at all.
Fixed cost overhead is what kills businesses. Variable cost, okay. So, you know, those variable installers.
Variable meaning that the costs go up with your revenue.
Right, right. Or you can get rid of that cost easily in a downturn.
Right.
So if those are contractor people that do the installations and the repairs for you, and, you know, they just get paid on the business.
Right.
So,
1099.
So, 1099 type people, that's not bad. Yeah. Okay. But if you got a W-2 them and pay them either way, be careful.
Yeah, totally agree. All right, guys, thank you very much for joining us. It was great to have Jason here on this live stream. He's heading back to the States tomorrow. He had a great time here in Medellin. I just want to remind everyone to go to georgegammon.com, sign up for that email list. If you're thinking about going to Rick Rule's resource conference in the summer up in Vancouver, do that through our affiliate link at georgegammon.com. Jason, where can everyone find you?
JasonHartman.com. And I just want to say a big thanks to George for, number one, being such a great host in Medellin the last 5 days, and also for all the great work he does that all you guys already know. So thank you, George, for having me. And I'm at JasonHartman.com.
Yeah, and the Creating Wealth Show. A lot of these questions that we've had today regarding real estate, I mean, you've got over 1,300 episodes there on the Creating Wealth Show.
So,
and you take a deep dive into a lot of these questions that we got today.
Absolutely. And I just had you on the show, and I got you on the show again tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So that's on iTunes or any podcast platform. Just type Jason Hartman or Creating Wealth. Jason Hartman, you'll find it. Yeah.
All right, guys. Enjoy your evening, and I will see you on tomorrow's video.
Happy investing.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.